Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Imogen Ragone, an Alexander Technique teacher in Wilmington, Delaware. And for this podcast, Imogen is going to interview me, and the subject is going to be the life of F. Matthias Alexander from perhaps a slightly different perspective than most Alexander teachers and students think of. So, Imogen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Robert. So, I'm curious to ask you first, what is this different perspective that you want to bring to F.M. Alexander's life?
Yeah. Yes. I want to sort of abstract away a lot of the details of what he did or didn't do, or did he miss opportunities? Did he have views on things that are a little embarrassing? Did he make mistakes? Did he come up with this idea or that idea on his own? Did he have help? I want to talk really about the very big picture of someone growing up in a pretty obscure part of the British Empire and ending up creating a system that's kind of morphed into, or maybe even was, the Alexander Technique. He never used that phrase himself, but a system where there are thousands of teachers coming up with new ideas, teaching many, perhaps hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of students. How did this one guy manage to pull that off? And what was he up against? And what can we say about it? So that's the big picture.
Yeah, that is big picture. Yeah. So, do you want to start? I mean, you kind of alluded to his obscure beginnings or the obscure part of the British Empire, i.e. Tasmania, where he was born and grew up. Do you want to start there?
Absolutely. I think it's really, I think there's a kind of a common theme that runs through at least the early part of Alexander's life, which is wherever he was on the wrong side of the tracks from the next place he went to. He was grew up in Tasmania, definitely the wrong side of the tracks for people in mainland Australia at the time, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And then Australia itself was not, from the point of view of Brits and England, Australia was kind of not the cool place. Both Australia and Tasmania were among other things dumping grounds for convicts and other undesirables.
Penal colony.
Well, Tasmania may not have been officially a penal colony. There were a fair number of people living there who actually went there voluntarily, but a very high percentage of the population of Tasmania were people who were shipped there as an alternative to spending time in prison. There was also on the island one of the most notorious prisons anywhere in the British Empire. It had the unusual feature of having no walls because there was absolutely no way you could escape. You would drown or be killed off, or didn't need to actually have walls. I mean, how economical is that? But Tasmania really was not a pleasant place at that time. It's not the sort of bucolic tourist destination that I think most Australians would think about it today. It was a pretty rough place, and one of the things that was going on the island, it pretty much came to an end when around the time Alexander was born in 1869, was the systematic slaughter of virtually all of the Aboriginals. It was done very quickly and very nastily, and much more intensely than it had ever been done in Australia itself. There are really no Tasmanian Aboriginals around to speak of, as far as I know. It was not a pleasant place. We don't know a lot about the economic situation of his family. It might have been a little bit above average in some ways, in that he did receive some sort of schooling. He had a tutor for a while. And one of the few things he had going for him is that he knew how to read and write. And that's what enabled him to get these jobs that he had while he was, also trying to build a career as an orator and actor. He had a series of jobs starting in Tasmania, and then when he moved to Sydney and later Melbourne, he had jobs that he would stay for a short time and then he would usually move on, but he had jobs that could support him. So he did have literacy, and that might have been not something that just anybody had at that time. Also,
So you,
he, yeah, go ahead.
well, you mentioned this him being sort of on the outside of the next, you know,
Next
like
place.
Tasmania being like on the outskirts or of Australia, and Australia being on the outskirts of the British Empire. Do you think this had an influence or this?
I think it was something he worked to overcome. Certainly, when jumping ahead a little bit, when he moved to England, apparently he people who would meet him after he'd been there a while assumed he was British. He didn't really talk about Australia, and he apparently had worked out a pretty convincing British accent. So that took took care of one of his problems there. But as I say, what he had going for him was he was illiterate. He was also apparently quite talented as an orator. He did have this problem from which the Alexander technique originated, but he had the possibility of earning some money by actually going on stage. And I think what we had is a situation where he's constantly moving on to a bigger metropolis. But certainly when he got to Sydney and later Melbourne, people in those cities, to the extent that they were even thinking about Tasmania, I think for the most part regarded it as a pretty unpleasant place. It was not where you wanted to go. And
So do we know? It sounds like when he was in England, he kind of hid his origin. Do you think, did he in Australia hide his Tasmanian origin?
We don't know. Maybe it was, I don't know. I don't know. I doubt that he advertised it, but maybe not. I can't say.
Yeah, I didn't know if that was
Yeah,
well, I
no,
don't know
there's
how you
no, there's,
document it, but you know what I mean.
yeah. But and when he got to England, actually, I think it's worth doing a little thought experiment about what he was up against in 1904. He had worked out a fair amount of stuff around the Alexander technique and how to teach and so on. But imagine yourself if you, with everything you know about the work, were to suddenly pull up stakes and move to a country where not only no one had ever heard of the Alexander technique, where there was essentially no Alexander technique. And so you couldn't hold yourself out as a teacher of the Alexander technique because no one would have a clue what you were talking about. And in a way, that's a little bit what Alexander was facing in England. He did have at least one letter of introduction from a prominent doctor in Australia to a prominent doctor in London, and I'm sure that helped him a lot. But you have to wonder what exactly happened when he got off the boat. Where did he go? Where did he stay? How did he start earning money to support himself? You know?
Is it in the biography?
The autobiography. There is an autobiography that Alexander wrote that ended sometime in Australia. There is a biography by a guy named Michael Block.
That's what I was referring to, the
I don't
biography.
know that he actually addressed that question. But just imagine yourself confronted with that situation. You show up somewhere, and how are you going to get people to try out what you have to offer? When
Is
there's
that when he started writing? When did he first started writing?
well, the one of the maybe it's a myth is was that he had written something, and he and by as the boat approached England, he decided it wasn't good and tossed it
I think I
overboard.
might have heard that.
Yeah, who knows? I think that's he started writing pretty soon after he got to England. He wrote letters, and of course I think by 1911 he had written a first version of Man's Supreme Inheritance. But by that time also he had met some famous people and given them lessons, particularly the actor Sir Irving, what was his name? Sir famous actor.
I know who you
Something, I forget
mean.
his name, but he was quite a well-known actor, and he seemed to have made all these connections with the right people, and you wonder how
See,
he did that. You know, he
how
didn't.
did he do
How did
that?
he do it? Well, I don't know the details, but I think he was the kind of guy that had maybe a certain chameleon-like ability to fit in new circumstances. Who knows? I think it was probably a combination of luck and pluck. You might say the kind of pluck that in Australia turned a penal colony into the land of Oz. He might have been just the kind of guy who could just show up and impress people. In a way, it reminds me a little of some politicians or people like televangelists in America, who so many of them have grown up poor and just are now out there selling their wares on TV and doing a great job of it. There's some people that just are able to do that. And I suspect that he was one of them in his kind of way.
I am remembering something from the Michael Block biography that I'm sure he mentioned something about, like, he bought himself like the finest clothes and found himself a place to live that was, the right sort of place. So he was creating a suitable persona to mix with the upper levels of society or whatever you want to call that.
And for all we know, he may have figured out how to shed his Australian accent pretty early on. So
Quite possibly. Who knows if he'd even worked on that in Australia as he was reciting Shakespeare, maybe with an English accent. I don't know.
Yeah, we
I'm
don't
just
know. But it's I'm pretty sure he dropped it fairly soon after he got to England, if not right away. And as you say, dressed well, lived in the right area. So he must have had a little money to kind of put out up front to create this persona. But you still have to get yourself invited to the right parties and stuff, right? To to and he managed to do that. And that's an amazing accomplishment in itself, really. And
It
then
is.
he gets to he does some traveling to the States, starting around 1914 or 15 or so, and he meets up with John Dewey and some other very prominent people in the educational establishment in New York, and manages to get Dewey to write introductions to three of his four books.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
He's always connecting with well-connected people. So you have to admire that, because I think without that there would be no Alexander Technique today. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah, you're probably right.
He might have just been someone that, had a few students, but no one didn't really go anywhere. And of course, he also created eventually created a training course and a way to bring forth more teachers of his method. There were some teachers early on that he trained informally, but formally, but he created this system, you might say, that somehow has more or less survived intact over 50 years after his death. And while there are debates and strains here and there, the basic system has grown, thousands of teachers. And the other thing that you got to remember about Alexander, and Michael Block in his book talks about that to some extent, that Alexander was constantly having to worry about poor relatives back in Australia.
Oh, right,
And he had
yes.
to send them money, and he had to bring some of them over. I mean, money was a constant worry, because he was in a way responsible for a lot of kind of feckless relatives back home, including his father.
And yet there's also the stories about him like putting it all on the races or
Well, the story about yeah, well, we don't it'd be,
I don't know the detail, but
it'd be interesting to
yeah.
have a record of his gambling losses and wins. I mean, supposedly it was a bet on the races that gave him the money that enabled him to go to England originally, right? Someone gave him a tip. He was riding on a bus. He bet made the bet and got enough money to go to England. And who knows, later in England, he certainly was interested in horse races, that's for sure, and he bet on them a lot, and maybe he was pretty good at that.
Yeah.
So, and
So do you think the fact that his origin was in acting was his original passion, and obviously that could help him with creating this new persona in the different places that he went, but also I wonder if there's something about the acting connection and actors that helped him get connected with famous people, and then to, I don't know, what do you think?
That's entire I mean, I think his acting background was a great help to him in, connecting with the right people, especially in England. I don't really know. I don't think we know exactly how his first students came to him, but somehow they did. And he of course also took the initiative of writing letters to the editor and writing little pamphlets and stuff. That, and of course the books came later. So, I mean, he was definitely out there in any way that he could. I'm sure if he were around today, he'd be on, he'd have a nice website, and he'd be out there on Twitter and Facebook and so on. But he was definitely not someone to hide his light under a bushel.
Certainly not, no.
Yeah. But you know, that's something I think that gets it's not really a secret, all this stuff, but it's kind of out there in plain sight. But I think people, when they talk about his life, tend to dwell on things like, you know, how did he come up with the idea for using mirrors to observe himself, or you know, details of his the Alexander development, Alexander technique development part of it. But I think this other aspect is pretty important as well.
Well, absolutely, and I'm just thinking from a marketing point of view, which you know, most Alexander technique teachers would probably not say they are good at marketing the technique
Right,
or
right,
their own practice.
right.
But he obviously had it down, and he went for those top prices. He wasn't he was going for the, you know. I don't know what you'd call it, the creme de la creme of society.
The 1%.
He was going for the 1%, and he was
Yeah.
charging prices,
Yeah, absolutely. That was part of it. And I
And he had
do.
the
Yeah, go
he
ahead.
had he had it sort of within him to be able to do that,
Right.
to create that. It's almost like he created.
Well, he was a self-made man,
Yeah,
really. You know,
yeah.
he was a self-made man. And you know, you have to think, well, if there are, let's say, 3 or 4, whatever thousand number of Alexander teachers in the world today, and even if only half of them were doing the kind of stuff Alexander was doing, it would be amazing, right?
Hi,
But as you say, many Alexander teachers don't really, they don't think of themselves as good at marketing, and they may not be good at marketing. And there's almost a feeling sometimes that you shouldn't have to market this work. It's so good
Right.
that, you know, people are going to find you, and marketing is a little suspect. Well, Alexander sure didn't take that tack in his own life, that's for
No,
sure.
he was out there making every connection he could. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
And, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
how are you seeing this perspective, which is where we started at looking at his life from this? How why is this important, or why do you think this is significant in some way?
Well, if you believe that Alexander came up with some really important discoveries that could help people improve the quality of their life, how they function and so on, good use of themselves, as we might say, it is sort of an object lesson in what's needed to get that out there into the world, that it isn't enough just to have a really spectacular idea. You need a way of getting it out there. Now, the way he chose as you say, he was going for the 1% as much as possible. But even if you're going for the 50%, you still have to you have to you have to do something. Non-doing isn't going to cut it for that. And I think that's a lesson that might be useful for some Alexander teachers today. I don't know. Other than that, I don't know. I don't know what I don't know what all the implications are, except maybe when we have these debates in the Alexander world. Right now, we have debates about the importance of hands-on versus working with people's thinking. That's an out there debate right now. There's another debate around, well, was Alexander is his big thing being the first Alexander teacher, or was his big thing preserving the work of François Delsarte, which would have largely gotten lost if Alexander hadn't hadn't had the good fortune to be exposed to it in Australia? Or how about Alexander's views on various topics? Some passages from his books are kind of iffy. Is that something we should worry about or not worry about? Those are the kinds of debates that are going on. And they're important debates, but they wouldn't be debates at all if there were no Alexander technique as we know it today. And that's what Alexander managed to pull off. So whatever you think about his personal views, his opinions, this, that, and the other thing, you got to give the guy some serious credit for having pulled something off.
Absolutely.
Has benefited mankind immensely.
So it sounds like that's kind of your message, if you want to call it that.
I think so.
Today's discussion that the way he, despite where he found himself and his circumstances, the way he was able to reinvent himself and get connected with the right people, shall we say, to give his prominence is what made his work so well known that now there are teachers and students all over the world.
Right. And all because this guy up in the north coast of Tasmania, not even near the city of Tasmania, Hobart. I mean, he was really
on the outskirts of Tasmania, which
I suppose, I mean, to the extent that Hobart was a hub, he was definitely far from it.
And then he found him. Then he managed to get himself to London, England, which at that time was pretty much the center of the known world.
I mean, that's if you were in Australia and you were looking to make it big, London was the place to go. Probably more so than anywhere in the States.
At that time.
I suppose you could add one bit of luck that he had, which actually occurred before he was born, that the younger brother of Francois Delsarte, Camille Delsarte, for reasons that are slightly bizarre, actually immigrated from France to Tasmania in 1851 and made the Delsarte method well known in theater and music circles in Australia, all over Australia. So it was around. The Delsarte method was around, the original Delsarte method. And it's doubtful that Alexander ever met him in person, as might have, but because I think Delsarte died when Alexander was about 8 or 9 years old. But Delsarte had left quite a mark on those kind of circles in Australia, and Alexander was traveling in those circles.
I mean, and that seems amazing, especially in the context of what we've just said about Tasmania in the scheme of the world.
Well, it might have been that Tasmania, while it wasn't a wonderful place to live, it might have been a good place to earn a living if you showed up and had some skills and were not a convict. And actually, Delsarte, I think, moved to the mainland fairly soon. After getting there, I think he retired back in Tasmania, but Delsarte was mostly in Australia. But it is odd that he specifically chose Tasmania, apparently for climate reasons. It's an amazing little coincidence.
So is there anything else you'd like to say on this topic?
I've said all I can think of, but it'd be interesting to hear some other people's reactions to this. There may be other perspectives on this that I haven't thought of, but to me it's just an amazing story apart from everything else.
It is indeed. So, well, thank you, Robert. And I'm going to hand back over to you to close out the podcast. podcast.
Yes, well, thank you, Imogen. And I'll just say again that my guest is Imogen Ragone, an Alexander teacher in Wilmington, Delaware. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.